the representation, and then have to engage the representation. But before we do that, why don't you introduce yourself quickly? Let's start with myself, we'll go this way, and end up this way. My name is Bamos, my surname is Masondo, M-A-S-O-N-D-O. I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning, my name is Fili Mapulani. I'm also a member of this committee.
Okay, David Masepe, a member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, my name is Mpule Roshiang, a member of this committee.
I'm Barilo Hosla, Statistician General of South Africa.
I was finding it difficult when you started by your first name, because in the village where I come from, only school children are referred to by first name. Otherwise, it's Babasbanban, Babasbanban. So, but my name is Rusela Maluleke. I work at SSA. I'm Deputy Director General for Statistical Collections and Outreach, which includes provinces and international statistical development. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Maya Ratas. I work for Statistical Africa, based in the Western Cape. Good morning, Maya Ratas. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I'm Yuri Jacobs. I also work for Stats SA. I'm based in Cape Town as District Manager, Cape Metro.
Good morning. My name is Arul Sivanathan Naidu. I'm the Executive Manager for Stakeholder Relations and Marketing in Pretoria of Statistics South Africa.
Thank you very much. Does that allow the member who just walked in to introduce herself? Name?
Good morning. My name is Nobuka Ntembo.
Good morning. My name is Andy Lekopomane. I'm the committee researcher.
Good morning. Shrin Kasim, the committee secretary.
Good morning. Lebo Hantekani, parliamentary liaison officer for COGTA Ministry.
Good morning. Sharon Kalanzi, DMG.
Good morning, I'm Lumza Bafu, committee assistant.
Thank you very much. That's all. Good morning, our members. Thank you very much for the invitation. We are pleased to be here. Yesterday we were in another appropriations committee discussing matters education, and today it will be matters local government. All these are indeed related because they derive from the same information system, which is about the people of South Africa and the functioning fears and works of life, but they go about that cohort of individuals moving through life in different circumstances. We got the brief, which was really talking about non-financial transfer of municipalities. Now, we thought for once and said, well, probably that's what we should talk about. But if we have to talk about non-financial transfers of municipalities, that has its limitations. In that, it might reflect how the SA functions, which is how it collects different series of data. And collect those and then produce results around a specific subject. But probably what is needed is more an intelligent way of dealing with those outputs in relation to all other outputs that are created in order to make sense of what this non-financial sensors might actually imply. So we took the liberty to expand and redefine the brief because we thought that if we were to take the brief as it is, it would reflect our responsibilities for collection of data instead of projecting the data for purposes of use. And when it gets used, it interacts with the variety of other data sets. So we have brought a hodgepodge of things that stimulates discussions towards use rather than what is it would be production purposes. I thought we needed to explain how we interpreted the risk and expanded on it. So, and in particular, we have done this because your disposition of foresight is very, very critical. And if we have to produce the data, it has to be rather for those who use it in large parts for monitoring and evaluation. And indeed, you need to use it in an integrated fashion because life doesn't work in an integrated way rather than in the way we produce it. And so we brought a few live examples of how this data is used and where we see limitations, both in use as well as what happens. And of course, we end up with what counselors should necessarily have, my ward, my counselor. And I think the individuals in your councils, in your ward, say that they are our counselors and these are the responsibilities that our counselors have. What I've also done is to look at how do individuals die in your own environment, because part of what you have to deal with is to at least postpone death as much as possible so that individuals can live productive lives. At least if they are employed, it would be nice, that would be productive. And then, of course, what services we provide more broadly and more generally. So we selected a few dimensions that we thought are important, particularly as they focus on poverty and how they impact on poverty, health, education, and living standards. And these are things that I think yourself that having responsibility would have oversight on. And of course, in these four dimensions, health, education, living standards, and economic activity, what the areas that you focus on would be things like child mortality, that is the number of children that die under 5, years of schooling, how many years children spend in school, in terms of living standards, lighting, heating, cooking, water sanitation, things like electricity, and then type of dwelling, and then aspects that people have. And then economic activity, the most alarming issue is unemployment as a key driver of poverty. So this is not a comprehensive structure of what your portfolio committee does, but in fact, these are the things that are driving the questions around development in South Africa. Now, the key area of focus are the indigents, and we will take you through this indigents and how the non-financial report on statistics and here we are looking at the issue of three basic policies, three basic services policy, rebates, and there we know that the rebates are 6 kiloliters per household per month, 50 kilowatts of electricity, sewerage, 50 rand equivalent of whatever sewer we produce, and then a solid waste management, that's 50 rand, that's also per month. And the target are the indigents. Now, in part the presentation we will look at is the indigenous policy working and what it fits in that. But probably these are the number of people that are said to be Indian. Almost 826,000 in the 827,000 in the Eastern Cape, where we have the highest number, and 419,000 in the Western Cape, 515,000 in Limpopo, and 335,000 in Gauteng. So total number of households that are Indian, there are 3.4 million households, out of about 15 million households. So let me preface this, that indigents are identified and they're registered. So it is a function of registration. It may be complete, it may not be complete. So in many ways, the numbers reflect in part the efficiency with which the administration actually does its job. So the number may be higher, that's reflecting that the administration is doing its job better in one of these contexts as to the other. But in general, the tests that are done to identify the Indians, those I think are uniform, but the progression towards the identification is a function of the efficiency. Here, what you see is a units that are accessed by South Africans 2009 to 2014. It looks like this is actually cut in the slides we may have to. But if it does, then we have a problem when we go to other slides. Okay. So consumer units, water sales is 2009, 9.7 million, that increasing to 11.8 million. That is a difference of about 2 million in a period of 4 years. 6.7 million to 7.9 million, a difference of 1 million there, 1.2 million in terms of access to water inside the dwelling. And 88% of South Africans in at the time received water within RDP status, and 90% in 2030. So this is the kind of progress in terms of the RDP standards that was set. When you look at that, there is progression. And of course, if we were to go back to 1996, you'll see that 2001 will be that things itself. Now, consumer units receiving basic water and key basic water, that is the 6 kiloliter household. And if you recall that the indigents, I don't think you remember the numbers exactly, but in the Western Cape the indigent was 440,000 households, and the Eastern Cape about 700,000 and 800,000. Now, the here we have the number of consumer units receiving basic water and key basic water. Here, the basic and key basic water can be received by including those who are not Indian. So it's everybody that receives this irrespective of status, but largely focusing on the Indian. And the blue numbers represent basic water, and the yellow numbers represent the free basic water. So here in the Western Cape, the number of Indian households were 444,000. Those that are using free basic water, which is to target indigents, are 944,000. So there is about 500,000 of households that are not entitled that are actually receiving free basic water. So it's an issue around targeting. How do you target? It's very difficult. So that's why I was saying, the immediate is the function of the register, the delivery of services because your target is you're trying to target an area. And in an area, you may find somebody is not indigent, but because that area is targeted as one that has access free base water, it also benefits because they are adapting that space. So we can look at these yellow numbers throughout different provinces. Here in County, 1 million are receiving free basic water, and then 2.8 receiving water. Now, I want to take us back to the table on indigents. This is 490,000 in Western Cape, 886 in Eastern Cape, 770, 335. And if we look at the numbers of people who are getting free basic water, who the difference there is 600,000 for Kapsum or 700,000. So, non-Indians are also benefiting. Then, of course, free basic water, that is what everyone is at the minimum entitled to, irrespective of danger. But free basic water is supposed to be for Indians. Here we are looking at poverty in the country. I'll get back to this because I'd like to go through a few other. So let me get back to it. I think I have to start there first. When we look at this free basic water, we could have gone to free basic electricity, we could have gone into social pensions, we could have gone into that. But what we are trying to build as a chain of a storyline. Now, having gone through this and provided this indigenous services, the question is there an impact? And an impact you can measure by looking at poverty levels, because the Indian policy targets poverty. And the question is, has there been an impact through the Indian policies and the cocktail of those? Have they impacted poverty? Now, measuring poverty, you measure it using multiple poverty indices. And here, you are looking at the intensity of poverty on this graph, intensity of poverty, and intensity of poverty, the depth of poverty, how intense it is. If you were to move from the rich person to the poor person, what is the gradient? How intense is that poverty? And then count this, how many in that intensity are poor? Now, these bubbles here, as you can see, is Western Area, Lame, Floor, Singa, Pace, Another land, that's lane. Each one of these has a name. These are your municipalities. So each one of these bubbles has a name. If you have to put all these names on all these bubbles, you will see what it means. If poverty is dealt with in terms of depth and in terms of headcount, what you will see is this graph would have a diagram. The movement would be along this diagram. That is, if you move down in terms of intensity, this way, and it will shrink this way to the left, if poverty is being impacted. If it's not impacted, this one will go up, and this one will go out that way, and you will see the clustering of these bubbles up here. So now let's play and see how these bubbles actually act. If they move that way, you know that things are going bad, in terms of headcount. If they are going that way, means in terms of depth of poverty, things that we said. If they are in all that way, it means that on both ends, these things are happening. If they move all this way, it means that poverty is detected. Now let's play it. Now, what we are seeing is that all those bubbles are actually moving more rapidly this way. That is, the head counts, number of people that are in poverty are actually reducing. The intensity somehow still remains, although things are getting better. But you can see that rate going up that way, so that it says that the difference, the poverty inequality is increasing in that rate. That's the field, yeah. So this is what this movement that we see here actually means. We turn earlier at the top, you can see that it's moving to the left, as well as a little bit down. This is on auto, so that you can see exactly. And see that things are not, poverty intensity still remains, but head count is reducing. in seeing that things are. So I think you got the hang of what. So each municipality you can look at relative to this, and the place you can see that. Now, in the end, what you get is this kind of picture compared to the earlier picture, which is this one. In the period of 2001 to 2011. So basically, what this picture tells you is that poverty has actually reduced. If you have your eyes on this point here, see that 60%. That's the starting point. And then where we end is that about 40, the last one. What is it? The opulence comes last in the crop. Yes, it was here 60. Now it's 40. So it means that poverty has been reduced. But the intensity, not to a large extent, because you can see, in terms of intensity, things started at about 47, we end up here at about 40, 45. That drop has not been that significant. So, if you look at the toilet facilities, how have the provinces played themselves out in terms of toilet facilities over a period of time, looking at who are getting better facilities in terms of toilet. We have seen where it indicates that there's no facilities, there is no access, dropping from 40 to about 25 to 20%. The eastern case has the largest network, and in that bubble means the size of the network. So this thing is in automotive, shows you how over time this has happened. Western Cape and housing have always been in a better space, but Eastern Cape was where things were not that great. And we have seen KwaZulu-Natal the mean moving that way. So I think we've got the sense of what has happened. Now we can have this poverty by disparity. And this is making the poverty count by municipality, then this is how things were. And we can actually say in terms of poverty, where does South Africa sit, where do South Africans sit? And here we are using these lines here. 321 is the food poverty line, that is if only I can get food. I don't care about shelter, I don't care about shoes, but let me just get some food. Here you are looking at, yes, there are some shoes and there is some shelter. Here is when you have a food, shelter, and a few other things and some choices. These are the food poverty lines. 321 rand, 443 rand, 630 rand. These lines are, we have revised them now. And we will release a report on where the upper lines are now as of 2014. So this is a food poverty line as of 2011. Now, usually when you look at multiple poverty indices, which is what this is about, you take, I need to go back to that starting point. These are the dimensions of poverty that we look at. And we look at all those things, including assets. You see this here, child mortality, years of schooling, lighting, heating, cooking, water, sanitation, dwelling, assets. Because poverty is not only a matter of income, but it's a matter of the multiplicity of things, and the measurable things. Now, this graph that I don't know what I'm doing, finishes that as an internet. Now, what we are looking at here in terms of poverty here is to look at both income poverty, which is upper bound, lower bound, but also multi-dimensions of poverty. This line here shows the multi-dimensions of poverty. And in it is a couple of points where we say if in any one of those dimensions you suffer poverty, in South Africa, where cut-off point is the 3%, we find that 8% of the population actually suffer multidimensional points. That is, they have one or the other needs not met. It could be education, it could be health, it could be other things. And that cut-off point is at 33%. And that cut-off that we are looking at of 33% affects 8% of the population. Now, when we look at that 8%, the present time it sits on the poverty line of 300 million rand. So, food poverty line, which is a money metric measure, which is a measure using money, corresponds neatly with a cut-off point of 33.5%, where we find 8% of our Africans actually saying we are poor both multidimensionally, but we are also poor in terms of income. Now, whether it's the same people saying that, that we haven't been descended, but there is a coincidence of this percentage as food quality line, and this is a very interesting that so the MDG report does show that the South Africa dropped from $1.35, and that the percentage which was about 15% dropped about 7-8%, which is this. Now, when we look at the 443, that's where this is 40% and 620, we find that almost 80% of South Africans are below that upper bound poverty line. So this is, so what this represents is that the policy positions that look at the indigenous three basic water, three basic electricity, and so on and so on, has had an impact on the reduction of poverty. That is 8%. It doesn't mean that 8% is a good number, but having reduced poverty to 8% is certainly a result that was in, is a result and the consequence of the action, policy actions that the government got. Now, we'll show you bubbles, but we can show you an app as well. Around 800 poverty, Singa, there you can see Singa was the highest, that's number one Singa here, and Tamakuru, and so on and so on. Tamakuru is number two, which is at the border, and you can see that this area that borders KZN and Eastern Cape actually has a fair concentration of poverty both here in the Eastern Cape and as well as pocket here in KwaZulu-Natal as well as Mlambo as number four. So, and Mkanyagut, right from afar, is also there as number three. You can show that how poverty was in 2001 using the same more or less similar measures. You can see the color coding of these areas here in my province. And when we move that way, you can see it has become much more greener, meaning that across the country, poverty has been impacted upon by policy positions that the government implemented. That 2001, now 2011, it has been much better. Now, what you need to understand is what are the drivers of poverty, and the issue, the fact that I preempted my presentation by saying we met with the Appropriations Committee yesterday, and we are talking about heritage. One of the key drivers of poverty, and here we are looking at 2001 and 2011, this bar represents what are the key drivers of poverty. You can see that access, railing, sanitation, water, and so on, these contribute fairly little. They contribute but not as much. And these are the areas where things were done, sanitation, railing, cooking, electricity, lighting. All those things now the public has, including school attendance. You can see that that has been there. But yes, for schooling, has a major impact, and it's the second highest in influencing poverty second to unemployment. And here they see that unemployment is the key that you have not, it was in 2001, but it has identified as the key driver. And associated with that are the years of school. So education and unemployment, of course, they are correlated very strongly and they are powerful. But these are the things now that we need to tackle. But the most important one, although this one is the most visible and impactful, but the most important one is how do you train and educate. So, unemployment, inequality, and poverty are all ailments that we have to deal with. Now, of course, this is what happens when there is unemployment and poverty and the like, and all kinds of things people manage to. And then, of course, in later studies, delivery protests, we can see them spiking or rising in number to almost a 20-time increase in these protests over a period of time from 2004 to 2012 when they were attacked. And we know where these major cities protests are, the Northwest, the red and the orange shows where the protests are. Very few in Limpopo and the Northern Cape. Somewhat few are in KZN, but all the other provinces have a high level of their protests, moving from 13% to 83% in the Western Cape. And this is where they have occurred. Of course, this is despite the services that we have shown, including water, basic water, and so on. Now, we thought that we need to discuss one thing which I think there will be impacting South Africa's development going forward. But we need to look backwards and say, what have we been doing? And one of the developments that have been very conspicuous and known, of course, the president 2 days ago, 5 days ago, launched the idea that the eBay port, a similar high profit problem was the Maputo port. And the question is, do we know exactly what happened in the Maputo port? Over that period since it was launched. And part of the service delivery, or part of the benefit of development is service delivery. Now we have to look back at the Maputo Corridor and say, what happened? Maximizing social development, employment opportunities, and increase the participation of historically disadvantaged groups. This was the touch line of the Maputo Corridor. I think these are we look at the infrastructure programs. What else say, well, how are we going to look at them in the future, monitor them and see whether they deliver. Now, we are looking at Maputo Corridor because it was a significant, one of the most significant corridor developments our country has had. And we can see where this Maputo Corridor starts, in Johannesburg and in Komati Port, and of course goes into Mozambique. And the provinces listed there is Limpang, Middleburg, Belfast, North Strait, and Komati Port. Now the question is, have these areas affected by the corridor, have they been better off compared to Kibabis, Tatu, Moroka, Rwandeki, and so on? And have they been better off compared to other municipalities across the country? Because if this has brought some visible development, then that development must be shown in that corridor being a better space to live in compared to the other. So we do that comparison. And these are the reported positive impacts on local communities, housing, more income, jobs, and these are the negative and the farmers say now we can't even cross this high road because we can't trace the other side and it just dislodged our social relations that we used to have. So I think that the roads are problematic. But it's just that some indicators to look at the impact of Maputo Kodo and on education, employment, migration, provision of basic services. And we use the census and the service to say, well, there may be a difference. Now, when we look at the population, we actually see that yes, the corridor since 1996 actually shows a proportion of the population 15 to 64, which is important, which was much higher than Mpumalanga and South Africa over time. But by 2011, that population, which was of wage age, has actually dropped below the Mpumalanga average. So that is a major indicator. Persons age, which is employed by sector, South Africa, that's what is happening. The MDC region, that's what is happening compared to Mpumalanga. In some instances, they are better than often Mpumalanga, but lower than the rest of the country. Agriculture, we see that the MDC region was performing much better than mining. And the rest of the country, also in retail, not struggle well. Infrastructure, and we are looking at this year by year, and what has happened. And in comparison from 1996 to where we are today, the question is, has this MDC region shown any significant difference when we compare with Mpumalanga and the rest of the country? When we look at agriculture here, we take agriculture here, and agriculture, the taking water is not that different. Infrastructure, employment, 1996 compared to 2001, compared to 2007. There is a lead of things happening there in the MDC region. Wholesale, we see the same proportions. So the question is, as the corridor, deliver these things in the local municipality. Number of in and out migrants 2001 to 2007 into those areas themselves, and the number of out migrants, you can see that there was a lot of movement into the area, particularly Malawi, and Mbombela, and Eastern, less so in these other two. Kakanye and Amakane. And then in as far as out migration from the MDC, you can see that Mbombela has actually helped the group of Mbombela. A lot of out migration. So this is what we are seeing in that corridor. So now we need to study this thing more exactly. I mean, there are other slides that we can show. But the broad conclusion is that corridor delivers worse in terms of trade between South African markets. But in terms of the people that live around that corridor, there hasn't really been any difference made of any significance. That's really the point that the presentation makes. And there are a critique of that. Probably one of the reasons why the corridor didn't make a dent is because it's too long. It's 600 kilometers. Too long a corridor. Corridor development functions when you have a node, which is like Joburg, and a node in Pretoria, and then it runs close. So don't call corridor development when there is no corridor. Where there is prospect for corridor development. Second, it's about who was monitoring those things that were supposed to be delivered by the corridor, such as skills development and so on and so on. But he said that, and it went to auto mode. So, as these things come, they need closer monitoring, closer watch, because then you know where are things are working on. Now, we want to expand a little bit from corridor development into what are the policy positions that the country has taken? Policy position is densification. And in terms of densification, you have to look at buildings. Because when you densify your buildings, your mosques, your houses, all that, And in the way you do this, you follow a particular legend. Well, these are values of theories and plan fast. And you can see housing had a high value followed by wealth in case 5.3 billion, 20 billion, quadrilateral, 20 billion. Now, the question is where these buildings are actually built. Because the space is very important when you do your work. You need a spatial delivery, spatial time. Because space is a driver of development or non-development. You don't have to go far, you just have to look at the other party need. We know how they use space to achieve development or non-development objectives. And that delivers so well amongst whites and delivers very bad for blacks. So space is a very important thing, and of course building completed, and these are the buildings completed, how you can see the 41.3 billion and so on. The question is, where are these buildings being built? So you can quantify in a year what is being spent. The question is, where is it being built? Because once it's built there, it's built there. So especially you can see between 2006 and 2013 what has happened across South Africa in terms of number of buildings completed. And how they still take in the cake, but mostly Pretoria, Swanee, where you compare what happened in 2006 and compare with what happened in 2010, you can see Swanee, the Western Cape here, so on. Now, the public policy is that these buildings must reduce, must be such that there is a deliberate reduction of time and cost of travel to places of work. And capital spending, therefore, will prefer that is done. Now, there's been work that we did on the city of Johannesburg, city of Cape Town, and the Rustenburg municipality, looking at the public expenditure, the darker the spots, the more we mean that the public expenditure is in those areas. And of course, public spending infrastructure and so on and so on, and this is the distribution of that public spending infrastructure, actually for all municipalities showing 80% hours of that. So, in terms of how public spending was geared and defined, that there is much in infrastructure, it looks like that objective is achieved. And then social and so housing as well. Now, special development framework means that the priorities that where we are in housing and that where the social investment in marginalized areas have been, southwest townships, total investment in the nodes, and then investment in the corridor, which would drive densification. Now, this is census 2001, and this census tells where people are living in housing. And this is what is telling you where people are living in 2011. Now, it's policy positions as where people are living, and they are away from any place that is actually industrialized. So the apartheid city model has been reinforced. The question is, where to from it? So there is agents, there is everything that is being provided here to support the reinforcement of an apartheid city space. Which policy positions that it should be? Now, what are the instruments that are used? So we are giving a corridor development, we are giving this one. So, the question going forward is, where were statistics all this time, as we actually went on this, and I think what we have to do is to think differently and say, well, people, places, and indeed possibilities. Now, the engagement must be about possibilities. and how rigorous those possibilities are assumed. And we have to use statistics to look at the baseline, monitor and evaluate what we are doing, change policy where it is needed, make the decisions that are required, increase our knowledge, our understanding, and use of these numbers by the leadership, and of course citizens and their state. And of course, the importance of spatial information training, telling you what is happening where, so that you are not taken by the fire. And there are many users, of course, there is something called information that we are using now. And your information is very important and generates sense, and the focus must be on people. And of course, there is something called big data and what we call official statistics which we are doing. And big data is really important because it's a delicate. There's a lot of data that comes in infrastructures, very confusing. We know about the revolution, the industrial revolution of data. It's a very important one, and you can see how data is going to influence. In fact, our model for planning and writing things must be based on that model. What does the data tell us and what we need to do? And we have to put data at the center of this. And of course, big data is unregulated, it's a byproduct of cell phones, it's unstructured and unfiltered, you will not understand it. It's very poor in terms of analytics, but let me drift a bit and say that big data actually allows the rebirth and the comeback of Bayesian theory of statistics, which is given that you know the following, what insights can you gain, and then that creates a baseline. And of course, that is just what ourselves, which are official statisticians, who are large geekers, the ones that you have to go and study and understand from the study. This one says, oh, you know from your frequency distribution, but you also know that there are these things that are happening. You don't know their cause, but you can see that it's happening. So what do you understand by those? So it's bringing both the frequencies, the features, and the device, and the theories on this, in the state of this thing. That's what they're doing. So let's just quickly go through what this tells us. You know, this is the bathtub here. This bathtub is about the percentage of those with flush toilets across all the wards, the municipalities, 240, 200 and something of them. And here it talks about the flush toilets. Now, what it shows is that, yes, at both tables, there are extreme concentrations of distribution. Unlike a distribution that would go that way, this one is a distribution that is a bathtub. It's not a bathtub that is put on a hand, so it's a cork and a socket, and you put it underneath that thing and you beat this thing and the hand is like itself. It shows my rural upbringing. It's a bathtub. So there are a number of municipalities that do not have flush or chemical toilets here. Less concentration of that. And there are those that have actually concentration. Graphically, it's fine. We can present this graphically. But we need to see it spatially. And spatially, this is what we can go to look at the words that are actually like Uzim, Nyandeni, and Kunzebo. Now, it comes like a lot in the ground of the economy. It's that tells you where the concentration of the thing is. The numbers are there. It is a rate removal, the same bathtub distribution we see here. This is where it is concentrated in the Eastern Cape. In Basha. By the way, it's a very productive agricultural area. When you read the census, it shows that the intensity of agricultural production, small agricultural production, not commercial, very, very heavy there. So the question is how the products are marketed. So I'm bringing another view of data on from an agricultural point of view. And then a proportion of unemployed, then see a different distribution here, not about tough, but that shape distribution. And here you see where, if you were to get counting, where this not Limpopo, not something, Pitakomo, and those areas where levels of unemployment are greater than 71%. That's where the rate is in Limpopo. Formal dwellings at one level, and then we can actually point to where the formal dwellings are, and we can see that here we have Bizana, and I don't want to pronounce that here there, because I think he has very difficult. I'm not going to pronounce it. And then if we look, I want to talk to head household unemployed, and then of course where it goes green, where head unemployed is greater than 48, so that's where head are unemployed. And the page names are written there in Limpopo. So, across the country you can show where the little water limited are. So the data available, what we need is to engage and see how we use the data and monitor consistently, because as you could see, that either the Maputo corridor or the development of the Joe Metro, things happened outside where the intentions were. There we can see where less than 5% access to water. Next to green, you see here is there is where there is water, but next nearby that are raining, there is water. So what that policy do around that? This bathtub here, or not bathtub, about the trees, they are concentrated only on one end. The distribution there is of latrines in Limpopo. Access to internet, that shows less than 10%. I mean, this whole thing about internet is about education. And that's the point that we're making to the committee yesterday, that access to technology is very, very important to ensure that people can have the right education. Because we are pressed for time, we have a backlog, and the world is not waiting for us. The question is, what are the strategies and alternatives to catch up? And internet access is absolutely crucial to give South African children an opportunity to see better. And if we have to massify, these technologies are the ones that should be used for massification. It makes it possible. Now, if we look at wards, pipe water inside the dwelling, we can look and go into wards. So my counselor, we can go there into wards and say, this is the ward that has to be concentrated on. So I look faster here, it's just the ward. And of course, times you don't know the ward number, and you don't hardly know your ward counselor, and they don't know the ward number. You know your place. And here, this is where the place name is important, Abakurusi. And Emma Lange. So the layers of Bika are there, you better say, so that when you tackle these things, you can talk people both from a political position using words, but from the normal things that people know, because word numbers are known. You always search for the word number when you go for voting. After that, you forget what that word number is. At times, you don't know your word number, let alone a word number. Now, this is an analysis on hotspots. Generally, I believe, or our view, let me not say believe, our view is that a poor area will be a poor area. But when you start looking at these things, neighbors are not necessarily poor. You just need to look at Francis and Alex. Quite different things. Now, by using hotspot analysis, you actually look at in the neighborhood of, are these neighbors? Are they neighbors? Because when they are neighbors, they must be uniform, they must be the same. But they are not. Geography tells us that neighbors are not necessarily the same. And here we are looking at underbite mortality. And we see that there are areas where under 5 mortality rate the fence that is very high and the ridge tapers off like that. Now, you can show where mortality is higher, those ridge spots, who reflect areas with high undervive mortality rate. And we have seen some areas here that we can see where this undervive mortality rate is very high in areas such as Dahas Kral. I don't think that the children spoke Dahas Kral, but Dahas Kral is in this high mortality. And mortality generally, we know that it's highest in the Free State that rule from the Free State and the one from Kautokeino, the trackers and everything. And types of diseases that kill people there are those that are infectious and largely cause associated with HIV and AIDS. So, we are going to take you through this journey of non-financial statistics to say, yes, there is non-financial intervention by government, but we need to give you the full spectrum of how society functions. So, I think what we need to do now is just to give you a bit of, that almost concludes my presentation. But all the data is certainly free. We watched three super cross training, spatial analysis, integrated statistical analysis. And Dr. Naidu, where do we have that thing now? I don't see it.
What?
The one that I gave to you yesterday.
It should be on the memory.
The thing that we have in memory. let me go. I thought I said you on something. We trusted that. I'll do the following as I conclude. Oh, it's on the stick here. No, my limitation has been trust. Lenny says it well, that trust is good, control is better. I've been defeated by trust here. But Dr. Naidu will come and rule a few things about what we do, honorable members, so that you can access the data. It's available free. And study trains on this data. That you can see it download. Right here. And by date. I'm already at the top. But I only can I. No, let's take it from the hard drive. Okay. The computer is not my drive. I'll have to see so much. But that's what we can do is also come and do a few. Are you ready? Let's not be transparent.
No, we have nothing to hide.
No, I think that's a good video. I think it's a good video. Imagine that area there. To talk about non-financial studies. But what he tried to do is to expand on that mandate of or scope of non-financial statistics. Today, how has our economy and how has our society performed in different areas of concern, including around the issues of poverty? And identify the key drivers of poverty is unemployment and education. I think we have also demonstrated where there have been policy failures. The question is how do this get fixed and why data is important in order that we deal with this policy failures going forward. In particular, I think what the members would do is the presidential infrastructure program. Very important to look into that and say what and how is it going to be a game changer, and what actions need to be taken to ensure that it becomes a game changer. Because that's what's important. How will it impact on local government structure, and how will it change? Because it's a very heavy thing. When it sits and settles on local government, it certainly is disruptive and necessarily so. That's why you say a faster and revolutionary change operating practice. It has been disruptive. It is being disruptive. How is it going to be monitored so that it yields the results that are intended? Because the examples that we have seen where we have spent by a lot of money annually, it does not yield them themselves. So where is the game changer? I think that's what we think we can engage. And from statistics of Africa, we think a contribution in game changing will be based on the data that tracks what is it that he tells us, what is it that we are doing. So this is what I thought our presentation Chair is attempting to elicit to honorable members. Now I think I have got that thing that I wanted, and we will then start you to retake questions, or you think
we take questions first in your presentation.
Okay, then we will, in the course of answering questions, we can actually throw in a whole range of things. But I'm almost where I wanted to be, Baba Mako.
We'll come back to you in the way that's suggested.
Yeah.
Maybe when you respond to the issues and then action responses like that, and let's see how far we agree with the goal. On the other side, I say that there are more people who have joined us, so we need to go through the process in the same way that we did for a hiring. That will just happen the way you are. But before you do that, first to say to the chairperson that we need to give his apology and we then assume the responsibilities of who are in the right and chair the meeting. But now that chair is here, may have to take over and run the process. What we have done up until now is ready to listen to a first presentation. And the author did say, that they changed the topic somewhat. So the focus is not just how they collect the data, but the use of this data. And then there's some of the challenges that monitor some of the challenges that we've heard and seen in the slides that are rising because of the work that they do in an ongoing basis. But I'd like One of the key issues that we are taking into account as we engage with them is this question of the presidential interventions and the kind of things that they need to track just to make sure that we have a sense of how the work is unfolding. Can we run through the interventions very briefly?
My name is Kevin Malam, I'm a member of the committee.
My name is Patran Goloko, I'm from the Department of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs.
Besides the point that we will come back to later.
I think what we will need to do probably is to engage and then the members here will, my team there will then engage them.
Okay.
Thank you.
Famous by the fact that
well is to improve service delivery, is to improve access and so on, is to whether those, you know, boundary changes actually translate into the changes that people would want to see, and how then they then affect the provincial numbers and so on that you have put up there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Maybe we must first thank the statistician general and the team for the presentation they've made to us. Even now we were looking at the survey on non-financial census of municipalities. But I think we benefited a great deal in the presentation of this survey in context, looking at other issues in the country. Now, it was quite I don't know how to say useful or what, to learn that statistically the introduction of the free basic services by local government, by municipalities, has indeed impacted on poverty in the country. Because although it's a disjointed, it's almost disjointed because it's applied by different municipalities in different parts of the country. But the impact has not really been evaluated by those municipalities. And I think it's information that is very useful for ourselves as we monitor these municipalities and how they implement the free basic services in relation to the developmental goals of the country about the reduction of poverty. Because I think all of us, in whatever we are located in the country, responsibilities and so forth, our preoccupation should be about the struggle challenges that are facing the country, unemployment, poverty and inequality. And anything that impacts on those three ills that are afflicting our society, I think should be welcome. It's quite refreshing to get that information. I think we do appreciate that. Now, one of the fundamental questions that we pose ourselves as we were going through the results of your census was whether is there any relationship or any correlation between the number of protests and the extent to which there is access to services by communities in various provinces. And I just picked up one thing, that I don't know what slide is that, but it is in the case that I think it's on page 35. Page 35, slide number, should be slide number 70, which says that the number of households, there's at least 50% of households having access to piped water. And you look at that against the number of protests in KZN, which is less, 8%. I think that is the only province that has got the least number of service delivery protests. All other provinces have got lots of protests. And if you look at the fact that the concentration of households which doesn't have access to pipe water is in the KZN. So one does not see the link between these two phenomenon. Service delivery protest and areas where our people has not really felt the impact of the introduction of democracy in terms of access to services. So I would like the team from Status A to further deliberate on that. I can quote a number of areas, but I think essentially that is the point that I would like you to speak to. Maputo Corridor Development, it's a little bit disappointed with the information. Because that project was one of the key projects of public-private partnership, where the state was to leverage resources from the private sector in the delivery of public services through that concession, because it was a concession. And one of the driving motivation at that stage was that there was going to be a multiplier effect as a result of the investment in that public road infrastructure. Not only to facilitate tourism and the movement of people, but also employment opportunities in the areas where the corridor development was going to go. So I don't know whether it is an indictment on that policy of drawing in private sector involvement in the delivery of public services. Because some critics have argued that the private sector people are the most ones who benefited a lot from this development. Many people are criticizing the e-toll. Actually, the Maputo Corridor Development is the most toll road in the country. And the private sector continues to extract some value out of their participation in the Maputo Corridor Development. Lastly, Chair, just to say that the the relationship between the years of schooling and the levels of poverty, but after unemployment, the difference between poverty and what is on the other side of poverty can help me, Mr. Lord. Well, the difference between poverty and a good life, if I may put it that way, is going to school. And I think this is a crucially important point that, even if it doesn't affect us in Cocta, but as members of the society generally, we need to preach that people must go to school. There is no way of getting out of poverty other than education. And the statistics have proven that. And which is a point that and I think it's very important just to make that observation, because we're members of this committee, but also we're activists within the society, or we're just members. Some of us are just members. Some of us, we regard ourselves as activists within the community. And I think this is a message that we must continue to preach. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairman. Of the day, Mpulane, a person, he has taken most of my notes. I think the presentation has been of a great assistance. It has been an empowerment to myself and also an eye-opener in terms of monitoring the activities that are taking place. like the loopholes that we are now experiencing in terms of the development that we are bringing to people in thinking that they will better their lives. And but at the end, we find ourselves having good initiatives but that are not benefiting people as the Maputo corridor issue. But maybe going forward, we need to ensure that we strengthen on monitoring. As we also made mention of the presidential infrastructure program, that as it's being implemented, we come closer to it, so that at the end of the day, we ensure that it yields the results that we are anticipating with it. My question will be in terms of the relationship that you maybe as the SSA are having with the local government. Because I think this information, if is with them, even the councillor at the ward level as a ward level as a ward councillor, having this information, it would be easy for the services to be given to people. It won't be of a challenge because I think because you go into the press of the country and you go to even areas where sometimes it's not easy maybe for them to reach, but the information that you have in, so in terms of the relationship, maybe that relationship and the information that you have, you give it to them so that at least it will be easy for them to be able to execute their responsibility. As it, I think.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of questions. The first is, and my colleague touched on it when he spoke about the correlation between service delivery protests and basic services. So the first is there some way that we can overlay various data sets to determine the correlation? I'll give you an example. The access, for example, to piped water and or flush toilets and its correlation with the infant mortality rate. You know, that to me is a logical one and something we should be looking at. Is there an increase in the infant mortality rate where we don't have piped water and proper sanitation? So these are the kind of things that I would want to know as a politician, as a ward councillor, and the access to the data is obviously very important. We've just heard that ward councillors need to be able to say, well, what is the issue? How do they get access to that information? So that's the second part of the question. The third is, in this non-financial census of municipalities, and it highlights some very, very interesting data, how reliable is your source data? The reason I ask the question is because, as I understand it, most of the data comes from the municipalities themselves. And yet, when you go back to them and question them on it, they say, no, we don't know anything about this. This is old data, it's old information, it's out of date, etc., etc. So I'm just asking how reliable, is this something that is being updated frequently, and are the municipalities prepared to stand by the information that they give you? So those are the three questions I need on. Thank you.
Next question is Adam Ted.
What's the relationship in terms of information policy linked to the declaration for lack of speaker? The relationship between municipality information, but the municipality is sitting with a lot of information. That how can we consolidate that information that comes from municipality into that state of government? So that we got one position. I'm saying this, Chair, because most of the time when it is the time for health, we go all over the place. Here we've got a local government that is sitting there with a lot of information that is not useful. Do you normally use that information or is that information for the municipality or to find a way into the land? And currently, how many percentage accurate with our KSA information? I know that you contested in a number of ways, but how far are we moving forward? Because it is about 80 to 90% of our information.
Very good.
Thank you, Chair. I think I must also thank this report, and also let me say, Chair, the Statistician General. I must say that I appreciate the work that he has been doing. For the first time to see a Statistician General very active where I'm coming from. I thought he had a house there in Port Elizabeth. if he doesn't have a house, he might have another wife there. but he takes some food. Because I used to see him every day. Because it's a kind of commitment that as politicians, people who represent people see, who understand the agency of the service to the people. That's the only thing I wanted to see. Seeing you every day, because I was there in the constituency when I was doing the work. Today I was so encouraged. See a person wearing a yellow or something. But isn't it? It's not the tradition general. That's encouraging. That kind of an official we need. I thought that, I must say that. There is a very important issue around special planning. In page, I think you, it's a certain pages there, you are saying, we have not seen a lot of movement in that area. The apartheid special planning framework still continue to exist. It has entrenched itself, and it's very clear that we are not making movement in that regard. I want to take it further, maybe we'll comment about it, because my view is that I've seen government investing on urban renewal. The same urban renewal continue to embrace the apartheid special framework. Yes, it is informed by building infrastructure in those areas. But it sends a message that continue to stay where you stay, if the resources are there. But I've not seen, what is your view in terms of investment in inner city development, in terms of transforming that special framework and also people living in it? But the kind of investment we have in getting in that space, taking us further in terms of addressing that. My view is that it's not. The lot of investment in urban renewal, very urban renewal investment, and inner city investment, bringing people to inner cities to stay there, that's to an extent. I know that local councillors are not even interested in that respect, because they're interested in RTP housing. If you start talk about building social housing, in a moment, please just think of Kevin Millian, you're building infrastructure for the whites, building infrastructure there. If you start development in that respect in the inner city, start to be problems. So this municipality continues to prioritize historical white areas. And you raise the issue of investment in terms of building infrastructure. My view is that it's not substantial what we're talking about. If you look into municipalities, what they invest in that respect, find out that the open spaces that are available are not there to address what we're raising. Instead, are there to address new investment in complexes and so on, which defeats the issue that we're raising. Do you think we'll have Kevin Millian staying towards the head in the future? Or we'll have a mixed arrangement of society if we continue like this? Am I correct to say there's no such concerted effort in government in terms of addressing what you're talking about? Thank you. That's the first one. I know, in Joburg, I know people always run and make Joburg and Ekambu. I know the rest being done in Joburg. Because of also the city was getting dilapidated and so on. There's a lot of work that the Josco, Soko and all other institutes that are doing in that respect. But I'm not talking about that. Please don't give me a Joburg example in this respect. Let's look into areas where we are raising that they are critically poverty. Also, I want to get to this thing. You are saying in the Western Cape, in terms of service delivery, the Western Cape, you in a slide, many slides. Okay, let me start with this slide, slide 21. Slide 21 in page 11. In 2004, you have seen, between 2004 and past, there's been an increase in public protest. Where this protest in 2005 contributed because of lack of delivery of services. Because you see a decline in 2005 and 2006 and the rise again in 2011. Does this reflect the kind of political issues in which the country was confronted with in this period? I'm asking this deliberately because the rise of public protest, can we relate this rise with the political issues of that time in the country? Because in this period you have Abu Khutsong, you have Morfong, you have the xenophobic attacks. But services in that period, government was accelerating service delivery in that period, and you could see tangible programs. Then the Western Cape issue, you have said in terms of sanitation, toilet facilities, the Western Cape's performance is better and helping with other provinces. But why do we see that the Western Cape have a 23% higher than any other? But your statistics shows that the performance of the Western Cape government in all these respects is better than any other, including the areas with the problems. Is this because of a political a political agenda, not only in the Western Cape, but also in other areas? Are these politically motivated public service, service delivery protests? And if it's like that, we must be able to identify that as a problem, because they are escalating and escalating. Nobody wants to cut it. I'm asking this because we must also check whether in the Western Cape, when this public, the self protest started to escalate in the Western Cape, they did not fuel all over the country because of what is happening in the Western Cape. Because I have the same belief that if you've been here, you think that you're going to manage it here, you encourage political instability here. Other people, they see us, we go almost, they can burn here in the Western Cape, they burn in other aspects, they burn in nine, in eight additional provinces, because they started here. We must be able to say these are politically motivated, because the reason was raised in that slide in 2004 to 2007. I have a view that public service, political public service delivery protests started in that period, and they never stopped. Because people got learned that you can just wake up and bend, even if you call it for the public representative, you just bend to it. Is it because we are unable to contain internal political issues, or does it reflect, speaks to your statistics, to the current service problems? Because your story does not communicate, does not relate with what is happening in the Western Cape. If you are saying double services and the output in terms of public service products, tell us, are we the problems as politicians in terms of this? How do we contain it? Because if it continues to grow like this, are we going to face a disaster or a problem? Let's go on education. You are case, I can go on public protest management.
Okay. I hope you understand this thing that I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
The investment we make, you're saying education can be used as a tool. I don't know what you're using to mitigate or to reduce poverty. But my question is that the instruments we have as a country to invest in this respect, do you think they are enough to assist us to achieve? Because seemingly you are beginning to say the only hope we have to speed behind poverty is to train our people. But we have instruments that are available already. CETAs, we have all these other instruments. But are they assisting us to accelerate reducing poverty in terms of whatever you have? The last one, in terms of receiving this, looking at this report as individuals, if I go to a website for this, can I be able to get into, as we are saying, you can get to this municipality and look into the statistics in this municipality. Just in a very, I know it might be there, but is it quick enough? Because if you want to look into information like this, detailed information, the system also must be able to help. I must not stand there for 30 minutes looking for something to understand. Therefore, it will discourage me to use this as a facility. Thank you very much. I hope I was not that long.
No. I'm very happy because it's a workshop, really. That we should all discuss some of these issues in the workshop, really. There's no line like that. And there are views also, there are views. But the decision general, I wanted to raise a point. Because I was always excited with your attend. Where is this hand now? Where is this hand? Because this hand started in 1994, or even part of that anyway. And then this hand grew. But where is this hand now? If the information that is there is that, and then black children, in terms of education, in fact, we have gone down rather than leveling the playing field. Because Tandi, I think Tandi was coming, okay, but Tandi is still now, in terms of all this, she's disappearing somewhere. I think it would be important for us to locate exactly where Tandi. I'm saying this here because if we all agree that we only measure the quality of our democracy, by the living standard of those who achieve low class. Because we can't measure with those who have privilege. And then we always measure the quality of democracy with those who achieve low class, who happen to be women, black women, African women was in particular. But where's the quality of life in terms of your data? Because the argument is that the most unemployed, the most uneducated, the most infected with diseases, all this. And that's important again, because I think, I'm saying this thing because Tandi is part of this team. Teaching education, little bit down again, I'm not sure where, I hope that she has not disappeared completely from the land. Because the point that we're raising earlier on, I think last year, that 1 million starts, rates are, this year, and then half of those disappeared in the system, and they simply disappeared. No one can trace them. Where are these people in the system? And but I think we're raising about education at the time, because if the fund that we're raising was Obama, I think also Phil was raising that the education that is going to assist us to defeat this scourge of poverty and inequality. I will call over years. I'm not saying that can happen tomorrow. But that's the point that I wanted to raise. Because therefore, we'll address the point that what do you think is a game changer now? Besides education, because it takes years. And I don't think we'll say that we must wait for a great army today until there are 20 years down the line. Because I don't think there's any patient there. I think the point that you're raising. And then we can talk about water and other things on that. But the point that I'm raising also that what is it that many statisticians generally are raising that information is there. Refined and processed information is there. I think that's what we were given as a good information. It is there, generally. But why there is this no correlation between what can use that information, particular Tanga? Why Tanga can't use that information? Because it's there, it's free, it's available, it's accurate. It's accurate. The information is accurate. That which hand has disappeared, if it's disappeared, I don't know if hand. But it seems the information is very accurate. Then where is this gap between the formulation of what we would do and the information that is there, that is processed, that is accurate? And the point that we are raising all over, that's the policy failures. I'm telling you that the information is there already, therefore, to inform the laying of information. What is this problem that is there in terms of your views, the decision journal? And I think we can discuss the point because we are raising some of the issues because we are caught ourselves. All this thing that is talking about the special development apartheid one generally, the person that he has to address himself because it's part of culture. And then the cooperative coming inside. And the point that I think also has been very confusing to me. People marching in standard. And I know that honorable term is from standard. They're marching in standard and they're saying away with the potholes or the things. And of course again saying away with the mayor. Away with the mayor. And the point that we are raising that generally speaking, there's no correlation between public protest and delivery services because the point that we are raising it in area that there are I think people have been asking this for the point I'm raising is the general. It's just to raising that accurate and scientific. Not really our general perception about life because it can be wrong also. But in areas even where there's really high delivery of services that people still protest. This route in Johannesburg, a little bit well developed now compared to us before. But I think there's protest almost every month there. And then the correlation between the two is always missing in my view. Because if they march, they are placards, all of them. They say, away this one, you want water, you want this one, you want this one. Simply means that in terms of the articulation, it's about basic services articulation. But in terms of motivation, is another issue that he is raising. Because that's the point I want to raise there. That maybe we should in ourselves at the policy level, because I think we policy failure also, the point that he is raising that. If it happened this way, it happened everywhere. I don't think it's systematic like that. Because the areas that are well developed, but there are still protests. The areas that are poorly developed, but there's no protest. Very developed. In fact, one area is the Kwafula Metro, where Honorable Shema is from. It's a rural area, Geneva. I don't think ever there's been ever a protest in that area. And because it's been very clear that the more people are educated, the more they understand their political responsibility, the more they understand their demand, the more they protest. And therefore, the bigger issue is the vice versa situation in this one. But the point that I thought the decision generally is very useful for us as a culture. And maybe as we move on, we will also assist us just to see what is that culture at the national level, particularly this committee, can do to assist you to address the very same concerns that we are raising, because it's a committee that coordinates activities of all spheres of cabinet. And I think it would be a good idea at the end, whatever time, to our team to assist us. Just to ensure that we educate ourselves, and then not 20 years down the line, we still come with the same information. Mm-hmm. But it sometimes less of information. That's the point that I wanted to raise. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I have a very competent team there that will actually look into the questions. I see that the machine here has probably blocking out, and I don't know the password. But you can give me the password.
There is no classified information.
Give me the password. No, no. Yeah. And I'm still getting some secrets. And I think that the questions really are very profound and require a lot more engagement. The data is very massive, and some of the things require a well thought through plan, monitoring, evaluation, and the like. And I think the future engagements must occur so that we can really move on this agenda. That's the first point I thought I could make to anchor the discussion. The second issue is, in fact, Presidency has not been able to visibly demonstrate the value of statistics. And when you prepare first case, that is not for the consumer to know that you have prepared them. It's for you to know where the consumers are. And you give them the first case and then they say, well, I think we have failed in that regard, and many statistics offices are failing in that regard the world over. And as you then start doing this work, you find that you are forcing an open door where people are already expecting that you do the following, and then the engagement process starts. Since we started the sense of the advocacy at the time where I was all over, I wish I had had both the house as well as leadership. But through that process, he really managed to drive the message and created the necessary visibility on the importance of data. But we need to do further engagement because in the processing and management of the data, understanding everything around it, you need a lot more. But we're getting there, I think, at the tail of the discussions, a rule we'll present. So more generally, I think that's how we want to anchor this. But the relationship with local government and application of the SSA and local government. Well, it's been a very difficult journey to get to where we are today. It's not been very easy to get into local government and say, here is the data. Because you've been there since 1996, 2001, and you attend meetings of COFSA. They give you a slot when they're about to leave. And so they are not listening. So we tried several times. But probably we should have demonstrated something earlier. So that when we try, they understand the significance. Rather than say, come and tell them that this is important. It doesn't work that way. So that's why we got the slot and the data and in different years as we tried to get to cope on the matters. The question on service delivery process. I think that the broader issue is how do you manage development information? If you manage it badly, it will bite you. If you manage it well, you'll get the result. So we are taking to manage development information as a country. And that's basically what we have at the heart of this. So that we can engage the expectation. Recall when Japan was hit by this disaster. Move that disaster to South Africa or any African country and imagine what would have happened. In Japan, all these guys were chewing, knowing that their turn will come. Nobody jumps to the front of the queue. They know that their turn will come. And that's how Japanese society manages its affairs. The expectations are managed even in disaster. Now, in South Africa, they have been very delivered. You can see the delivery. But in the process of that delivery, it's a competitive environment. And the nature of the competition is political. Mm. And politics creates a situation that makes expectations unmanageable. Must put them here. it's that problem. Because the pace of delivery is uncontested in the numbers. Well, of course, delivery creates its own problems. But I think those problems are a minor part compared to a distracting political conversation. And so, linked to that is, can you densify when you want your constituency to be a member and representative? Because if you densify, you are removing your spatial influence. And that's why you have to build RPP houses all over so that you can be a representative. So defeating the densification policy. So the problem is here, to be quite blunt. But in fact, it is here because we don't have the data. Because I think if the horrors of what we are doing are visible here and we can talk to them, it will change the way we do things. Because at the heart of information is transformation. Information produced transparently, it activates data, it enhances accountability. And because the results are shared, and we see them all of us, we can transform. Therefore, so let me say that the problem is has to be solved by yourself, unfortunately. But proportionately, let me not say unfortunately, by yourself, fortunately. Ours is to ensure that we provide the data, which we have not done. So we take the share of the blame. I mean, if people say that politicians lack political will, no. Politicians' will is driven by facts. There's no will that is given by God. It's given by facts. And if those who have to provide the facts don't come, the will, the source, the will, that is the fault of the will. And when it's absence of data, that fault goes. And then anything goes. So I thought that I have to provide a broader perspective. And I think there are a whole range of questions to answer. The questions of how we access the information, I think Dr. Naiji and will answer those and also demonstrate how the data is used. Indeed, when you look at Kautei, both from Metro and Swanee and all other places like Mangaung, we see an urban sprawl. So the investment is contested between the urban densification and the urban sprawl. And of course the urban sprawl sprawls itself. And people build, and then you have to provide services to sustain that urban sprawl. So it's a self-defeating process. Until we actually say, no, this is where things will be. And then, of course, the malls and then the gated communities just go and build, and then the municipality provides services. It is all the combination of undoing apartheid, but without having the strength and will of how apartheid did itself. At the minimum, you need the strength and will of apartheid architecture. At best, you need more determination to deal with it. If we don't have that level of determination, it's going to defeat us. And it's defeating us on all around. Solving issues around housing and so on, it's important that when we focus further, we probably represent palliatives to the malady and everything below. It eats us up. CTA is where it says in this village, what is the tail, ultimately eats the head. And whatever you allow to happen, and things that do not come to you, to finally come and eat. And the Maputo Corridor, I think strengthening trade between South Africa and Maputo was one of the key things that is happening, and it has succeeded handsome. But the other things that were there, that were supposed to be delivered,
the data shows that there is no evidence that those have been given. There is no difference between the corridor and the areas that do not have corridor. So, whichever indicator you look at, in fact, I think you map process along the corridor, you realize that it brought with it a lot of process. And the scientific reasoning behind this is that when you look at the corridor amongst other things, it was just too long. It was a long corridor. So, because of that, most of the benefits get dissipated. So, the key issue is your corridor must be of a length that allows centers to influence one the other. And it's always the two nodes must be sufficiently close to generate a node in between. And focus must be on that node in between to influence both directions. Why in Popo there are no protests and why what can be done to ensure that they are there? I think what the members are not aware of is that, and it's important to me this point, there was a plan in Limpopo in 2001-2002. I'm solely aware of this plan because Ben Parcella, who was in Limpopo Finance, was driving the plan and were supplying him the data to look at key things. And he will follow the growth of Limpopo. When they started implementing that plan, Limpopo growth was 6%. Instead, Limpopo used to be the poorest, the shame of the shames. And through that plan, PC growth and approached that the statistics of organizations. Now, that's where we complete. We use that data extensively to project on the Midupi, the Platinum, all those, to look at spatially where are these things, and given the intensity of the population and this, what is to be done. So, go back there, and you understand why a process in Limpopo. Where that goes. We have been partial efforts, and I know how we handle this, and we generated what is called development information framework. That showed where intensity indices were not satisfactory and were terrible. And with the government of Limpopo, they set targets as to how they were going to do that. And of course, what they are seeing now is actually an extension of that plan. I doubt if Limpopo will have a protest unless we do something else to make them die. But the solution, the medicine of the protest, was understanding how Limpopo's life, demography is, how the finances requirements are, and you see growth in Limpopo. It was the fastest growing province for some time. So that was the solution to the Limpopo issues. The question of boundary changes, let's start with the pathology. The point about this data in the way we present it is, it actually shows you what less than what is happening. And therefore, citizens can argue their case. But they are similar to that word, why should that one get preference? And of course, politically, actions can be taken through and decisions made. Because these decisions have to be political. Or not political. They have to be data driven, but at the level of actually the priorities, how to do this, is a political process. So the data are there to drive political decisions. The data doesn't make decisions, but it should help the quality of the political discourse towards arriving at the decision. Because the data doesn't substitute policy, it can't. Boundary changes. we followed the bounty changes in terms of, and we benchmark the bounty changes to the latest change, and then encompass those that were there in 1996, and then that's how we normalize the changes. We move towards the latest change, and then say that what changes have occurred in those spaces. Checking whether the changes in the boundaries have made others who were claiming to be better off if they are included in province A or province B, that we haven't tracked. But I can say in 1993, when the discussion about boundary changes were put on the table, we made a representation at the time. I remember when we made a representation on hotspots. Kuzong was one of them. So was the one, the boundary between KwaZulu-Natal and Central. On the basis of central base theory and the economic basis of South Africa, it just became a result that was making Bob and then West in Northwest. We made presentations that call Northwest. It is El Haragu and all these other areas don't belong to you. They are part of the economy of county. And it will be desirable during horse trade that this part goes to county. I think that eased the situation in the Northwest, whereby they never protested. Because the data was driving that, and we are actually telling, saying to a premier public that this is the situation. So, I'm mentioning the names in the way I'm doing to demonstrate that these things have been done before. What we need is to be aware that they can be done and replicate. I'm not mentioning the names for purposes of recognizing people, but it basically says, oh, this intelligence has always been there. But it was difficult in the noise of politics to make this intelligence surface. I think what I would say that my colleagues should answer, because there are very many specific questions, and I think Dr. Naido may wish to do other things that he answers this question. I will also come back and answer, and if you want to start.
Chair, I'm a villager, so I stay in Pretoria, and I send money to my parents. So money leaves my account in Pretoria. It's my bank is in Pretoria. Deposited electronically or by whatever means my mother receives it. The following day she receives it. She goes to she goes to the same Shoprite. She buys and Shoprite and then she leaves with no money. So as soon as she's bought the Shoprite, Shoprite deposits the money into their account. Their account is in Johannesburg. So money left Johannesburg, got transacted. So I would as well have bought goods from Johannesburg and asked my mother to collect from the village. So the question is, how do you deal with development when the levers of development are centralized? And I think that's a very big question. When you look at that, it's not only the statistician general spoke about the apartheid city space. It's not the apartheid city space that replicates itself. It's because the infrastructure that we have tends to replicate itself. That my mother is never even take the money to the village to support a little shop existing there, this other shop there. So she just receives money and it's back to Johannesburg the following day. Now, let us come to... I want to start with this point of how the apartheid city structure is replicating itself. And I think many of us have watched in horror or with horror the developments that have occurred in Marikana, and we're worried. And I think it's a social, serious, serious problem. But Marikana produces platinum, so is Pegasport. Both of them produce platinum. But since 1994, and I yet have to be reminded, which town has emerged in the new democracy that we have created? that doesn't reinforce the apartheid city structure, because what we have done is just to make extensions to that city structure. And it was properly designed. I mean, you look at Pretoria sometimes. Sati and I have spent a lot of time at Stellenbosch combining statistics, and not the two of us, with other colleagues. We spent a year there. Senior colleagues left office and said, let's go and deal with this issue. You look at Pretoria, to the west there's a buffer of Marabastad, there is a Lodiam. Marabastad is run by the Indian Society, so that whatever falls from the city center, they can receive in the form of business. If you go to the northeast, you find EL Serras with a bit of industries so that they can work on the farms. And your labor supplies in the form of Mamelodi, Soshanguve, and Atteridgeville. And nothing that we're doing at the stage in the development of Pretoria, nor Johannesburg, nor Durban, or nor Cape Town, that changes that. So in the form, we're just perpetuating that, and the data keeps on saying, even if you can see a bit of a mix in the races, and we saw it in the FAR. We did a study in the FAR, and you can see an improvement in the mix, but the structure has remained there, and until maybe they are dismantled, we'll have a lot more challenges, because the money that comes from Bakersfield in the Platinum Belt goes straight to Joburg. The money that comes from Marikana either goes to Rustenburg or comes to Johannesburg. That is why you see Rustenburg actually developing, and the geography there is showing and perpetuating the same city structure that we're talking about. And in the end, the poor always flow the rich. So when you have people intent developing themselves, the people will establish in deep slot. If you come along the N14, you leave Oliven, Holtbosch, Deep Slot. As you go towards the meetings, there's a group of small, they started being three or four. Now there are more than 300 informal dwellings there, and they are establishing them because it's easier for them to foot to work to the richer areas, in the four ways areas, in the Sandton areas, in Pretoria West areas, as well as, and then when they are there, they create a need for services. Government cannot ignore them. They need water, they need electricity. So even in the way, if we don't deal with this thing in a holistic manner, it will start with one or two people, and they create a perpetuation of that. In Angola, in Luanda, I used to deal with projects out there. It was quite interesting. A few times, it would take us about 2.5 hours to traverse 17 kilometers by a car. So we could as well have walked to a meeting. Because traffic just doesn't move. It just doesn't move at all. And now they started a new project called New Luanda. And among the discussions that they were looking was, how do they change from the old city structure system to a structure that would actually take into account the people that had suffered the ravages of the war, that had actually moved into the city, and be accommodated in a way that would cause a new development system. Of course, the biggest challenge was that they didn't have census data. It's for that reason that Angola, the work that we do on in the international front, has had to also run a census to address this kind of an issue. So, this issue of service delivery protests, the SGS, I don't know. It's quite interesting because I think there are so many scholars in South Africa who have tried to, I think we have seen more comments in the newspapers and in the media than an in-depth study and understanding of what the issues are. Because our data has shown that from 1996 to 2001 when we ran the second census, to 2007 when we ran the large-scale community survey, and 2011 when we ran another third census in the democracy. There is improvement in service delivery, especially in the area of electrification. We have seen a lot of improvements. We have seen a lot of connections of taps in rural areas. The biggest problem is that in some areas the taps are there, but water doesn't come out. But we have seen a lot of outreach
to what you would call informal settlements in the form of electrification, water reticulation, sometimes to the most minimum bed. People share communal ablution facilities, but they are there. And you also have found that schools are there, yet they are service delivery protect. So I'm saying that it's much more bigger. It should be much more bigger than what is being done. And it could be a changing political structure system. It could be a social issue. But the question that I keep on asking, and we had a very difficult debate recently in SSA, that took us 3-4 months about the way we wanted to do things. And we were open about it. We were actually at each other's throats, but open about this issue. The point was that do we have free speech? How much do we take free speech? When I talk openly about issues, do I become relevant or irrelevant among people that I trust, among people that should trust me? And if we can't have sufficient and open free speech on issues that matter, if we can't sit here and talk about the word apartheid or black and white, then we have actually ceased to deal with issues that matter. And the day we cease to talk about issues that matter, we may as well close shop and say we don't have anything that matters. But that's specifically to the issue of how our outreach programs are, is that we have not only provincial offices, we have the 9 provincial offices, and we have worked very well with provincial government, and especially we have seen good working relationships in KwaZulu-Natal, in Gauteng, we are improving in Limpopo, we're improving, but the KwaZulu-Natal government, the provincial government, not only has waited for us to go and provide them with the data, but have come to us and demanded the data and say, show us where the problems are. We have seen actually by now 3 premiers in a row that have even come to sit with us and sit in the meetings that are planning that okay, and sit with the planners themselves and say, let me first understand what the data is saying. And we are seeing it in other provinces as well. At a local level, we are having district offices, and much at the beginning were for the collection of the information that we need. However, we are now improving in terms of an outreach program that should supply the information. But the thing that still eludes us, especially at local level, is IDPs. Stati and I and other colleagues, Dr. Naidu, sat at Stellenbosch for a year, and I actually checked IDPs myself. I was surprised that municipalities, the data is there, but they don't have the capacity to deal with the data. So what they do, the first version of the IDP is the same data, sometimes even the same sentences. The second version is it's just cut and paste. Third version is the same. Even when data has changed, they haven't changed the thing. We have seen KwaZulu-Natal, the IDPs were relatively changing a lot in all the districts, all the municipalities. At least in the Northwest, we saw some changes, but in most of the provinces, it was quite disappointing that we couldn't see changes, that 3-4 generations of IDPs were written verbatim, word for word, number for number, even when the numbers had changed. So what we have done is we have said we need to improve on the issues of outreach on IDPs, and Dr. Naidu has started not only training our colleagues at the department at DICO, but also beyond that, we want to work with municipalities and ensure that we train them in the appreciation of the data, so that when data changes and the kind of products that we have, because I guess not so many people are aware, and I think there was a question, can we get easy access to your website, because almost everyone carries an iPad, an iPhone, or a phone. Even my grandmother's phone now can go on a web and get data. The question is, can when she go to, let us say, quickly access the data, or the data just jump out and say, here am I, use me. So people should just put a few indicators, whether it's on Google or something, and a search engine should actually pull out that data. So we also have to make such improvements, even on our website, to even assist people who are not daily users of the ICT technology to kind of be able to pick up the work that we need
the data that they need for the work that they do on a daily basis. And one of the things that we've been doing as well is the Isibalo lecture series, where we go out to beyond national and go to provinces and sometimes districts and encourage your municipal managers, your councillors. We give them our data and we sit with them and they work on presentations on their own and bring in a number of users and listeners, and they present, including learners at high school level who use this data. And we have seen that working a lot across all provinces, but still again, mainly in KwaZulu-Natal, the uptake was actually surprising. But almost every week we get one or two schools that say, now we have looked at your data, we want to come and share with you what we think we understand. And the municipal managers and the councillors sitting there, it's quite encouraging on what they find out. One councillor made us laugh last year when he said he was sure that he was shocked when he looked at the data for the first time, because the people he expected to vote for him, the data told him that there was a different group of people in that area that he didn't know. And when he went to campaign, he was sure he would win the vote, and indeed he did win the elections in the last elections. These are kinds of things that we continue to do in terms of our outreach program. We don't think it is sufficient that people will come to ask for data. We must go to them, but also train them to use the data. There was also a question, and this is my last comment, in relation to the municipalities have the data. Now, how do we as statisticians not just take that data and use it as official statistics? It's two levels. We are much more willing, and in what we call the national statistics system, we want to recognize administrative data, because what we do ourselves, we go to the households and talk to the people directly, and we collect the data. Look at victims of crime. If you go to the police station, you will find that data crimes congregated around the police station. Because if I bump upon a road 30 kilometers or 50 kilometers outside the city, I don't have time. If I'm 200 kilometers in my village, I don't have time to record the case there. So what I do is that I carry the hood and come and claim that the accident happened in corner so-and-so next to the police station. And that's how it will be reported. Now, the other thing, especially with was the violent crime or domestic crime, if you don't talk to the people directly, I mean, there are cases where we were dealing with victims of crime that we wanted to talk to the people we had suffered, and you would see some family members wanting to know, but what are you talking to her about? They want to know. So sometimes it's critical that you talk to the households and you talk to the people affected directly. But as we do that, we need to look at the kind of data that comes from administrative records, hospitals, education systems, and local government. Now the challenge is here. For it to be official, people that have interest in the data usually will up or lower the data based on what the incentive is. Look at the school principals. I mean, it's all very good that the number of enrollment at the beginning of the year is very high, and when you go there and you look for the learners, they are never there. Because you have to be paid based on the number of learners as a principal that you have in your school. So you need a system that should actually de-incentify the situation so that the data that you get is credible. It's the same with local government. Almost every municipality with the equitable share formula would always want to have their population higher than any other municipality on land, so that they can always get more money than the other. So it's the same with every province. The Western Cape province at some stage even almost took us to court because they said the numbers are lower. It can't come that they are lower. It's just that they didn't go further with that. But we have had such threats from provinces from time to time that our numbers are actually lower than we expected. We won't get more money. And it does compound issues. So you need that when you have status say, certifying that the data is official, it has to meet certain prescripts in terms of data quality. And in the national statistics system, that's what we are moving toward in terms of assisting not only municipalities, but other government departments, so that makes data collection a lot more cheaper in the nation. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm going to start by making a comment on the municipal data.
I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, the Statistician General wanted to check the administrative record of municipalities. So he sent out a questionnaire and said, can you give us this information? And when the information came back, he found a very strong similarity between the questionnaire and Census 2001. Then he called one of the municipalities and said, you know, the data you sent. He said, well, it must be the same because we just copied all the census data and gave back to you. But it highlights a most serious problem. That is, if you think in terms of your own electricity bill, when you go to a municipality, they have transactional data. They can tell me what my account is for this month. They can even go back 24 months and print my bill. But when you ask them what's the bill for the street or how many people in the street, the system is not yet for that. And I think that is one of the problems that we have with administrative data that we need to address. So I think that... Honorable members, I don't have a full presentation, but I thought that we would listen to the questions that you have, and then I will just take part of my presentation which answers some of your questions. So I'm going to skip through the slides and come to this one here. If you look at this slide, which is talking about education, can't see the event, but if you look at it on the mouse, here you've got the years, and this is the proportion of percentage of people who had passed, and we're looking at grade 10, which in the old days was junior certificate or standard 8, and the different communities. If you look back in 1930, you can see the white community as far back as 1930, more than 70% of the community had passed grade 10 or standard 8, whereas the Indian and white communities were very much in here. And then what you should look at is the Indian and the African communities from 1930 to about 1952, they were being educated at the same rate. You can see the lines are one on top of the other, right? Until 1952, when the then Minister of Education, Dr. Verhoeven, said, why teach mathematics to a bunch of child, and introduced Bantu education. Now look what happens to the blue line and the yellow line from 1950s to the early 1970s. You can see the blue line is virtually parallel to the X-axis, whereas the yellow line for the Indian community continued to grow. And then after the 1976 student uprising, you can see the blue line is going up and catching up. Now this is the data. And look again, the white community, where the line is, and look at the line for the African communities. And this then translates into the average household income from 2011. The average for an African household is 60,000, whereas the white is 365 and the Indian 250. And that is just what honorable members are saying, how important education is. And in the next slide, if you got this, for the white community, you can see what kind of normal distribution white men out here. But if you look at the African men, you're seeing a bimodal distribution. It's virtually impossible for this group to jump over that divide and start earning. And if you look back to the Planning Commission, the video on the young African girl, Tandi, at 18, passed matric and couldn't find a job. And couldn't have... Although she had a university entrance exam, she couldn't afford to go to university, so it was part-time jobs, always living below the poverty line. And the only time she got a salary on the poverty line was when she turned 60 and gets a state pension. So you can see this divide, and that is what policy needs to address. I want to go there to a second case which affects municipalities a lot, as I show you. And this is those of you who have some statistics background know that if you've got two data sets, the average is the same and the standard deviation is the same. The medians are slightly different, so you say it's not exact. So we all like to see things visually, so we say let's do a histogram and now let's look. And you see they're not exactly the same two data sets. So in all the years, most of us as statisticians will say there's no statistical significant difference between the data. But if you now, and this is what happened, I joined Stats, and the first thing the SG did, and you had the chief say, go full-time to university to study geography. And when I went to school, the students who did geography were those who couldn't do mathematics and physical science. So I looked down upon geography. But when I went to Stellenbosch, what geography introduced us to was texture. And if you look at these data sets, the data set on the left is data set B. The low values of B are clustered, rather than data set A, they are not clustered.
And we miss this very important aspect if we analyze data without looking at geography. And earlier in the Statistician General's presentation, when he talked about the bathtub, you saw we could identify those wards or areas that fell in one of those bars, spatially, so you can see where it is in the country. And that's the value. And I think this is what municipalities need to take into account. Not all of them are using statistics data for their analysis. What we are able to offer in answering the question of how you get the data, in StatsSA, if you look at provinces and if you color code it, these thematic maps are there from the day we went to school, primary school atlases, the oceans were blue and the fields were green and so on. 60 seconds.
I am glad we came up. I didn't know how to get back.
What we're able to do is that we can take a particular province like Western Cape, and we can split it into main places, and in the country we have about 6,000 main places, and then we can take an end place like Greater Field and split it more into sub places. So Swellen Dam and Sievers are sub places, and if I go back to the, we then can split the sub places into small area layers. So what's happening is that we can take the country and divide it into 85,000 pockets or polygons. And for each of these pockets, we can give you 75 variables from the census so that you can do your analysis and look at the comparisons. And then we also have the software where in the census we give you the codes, and that's in our data. And this data is given free from our geography. And then this is the data that we give you at Supercross. So you can go in and look at any specific area and see what it looks like. So you can look at how many people live there, do they have services, what's the unemployment rate. And this is the software that we'd like to load on everybody's machine. We're doing this all over. So this software is available. We have license to give it on every machine so you can run it. And we can also offer the free training on how to use it. And I think, so what you'd be able to do is once you've joined them, you can now do color coding, you can show pie charts, you can do bar charts. So eventually then all your reports, So all your reports then should be with a table, with a graph, and a map. And this is what we have. Shall we come to another question that came in earlier? This was the question on the correlation and the integrated analysis. There has been some discussion in SATS on what is the role of an official SATS organization. Do we just collect the data and we give it to you? Now I think you must see SATS as two parts. We have a production unit which I tend to refer as planting lilies. They plant the lilies and they bring the crop to market, now they're going to go back and plant again. It's not like a mango farmer who can go on holiday and come back again and his tree is full of mangoes. So you've got that cycle that continuously went through. But SATS marketing division for many years has focused on selling data. You remember the 96 data census, one CD, the consultant advised $100,000. At that time it was the rand for six, they were 600,000 rands for one CD of data. We now get the data free. So what has happened is the change in the marketing division. I have a PhD in statistics and I head the marketing division, and under me I have 20 statisticians who are now available to not only train you, but also help you with the analysis. If you email us any data, any kind of analysis that you want, we are able to not just analyze it, we give it to you back with a map, so you can get a very overall picture of what is happening. So when it comes to the correlation and the integrated analysis, we've started some of that, so we offer the service to you that we are able to do it. And I think that is why you're interacting with StatsSA now and not previously, because the change in the way we are working. We've gone further, not only look at the analysis in terms of, I think the example that was given was in terms of poverty, infant mortality, and the deaths. We could also look at causes of death through interstitial diseases that comes through. And what we've done in that respect, I want to show you one slide. Where it is it in the front? It might be easier to see. Yeah, look at this. This is the unfortunate case where the little child died in Limpopo in the silence. When we went and looked at the census data, the community around them, 90% live in brick houses. 93% have electricity. 93% have pipe water inside the drilling. 1% have flush furnace. Why? And this is the thing that, I started to say, we present the data. We cannot say it's good or bad or why. We just present the data to you, and you can then interpret it and use it in the policy. And I also put in this, the other slide is here. No, it's earlier, we've got the other slide. I want to show you another slide very quickly. Get up. I think it was on this presentation. We did a similar study for Bloemfontein. We did this study in Bloemfontein, and we found a similar in Bloemfontein. It was fortunate that the tile was rescued. Also fell into a pit latrine, and she was rescued. This was February 2014. And if you look again, look at the number of trailer houses that have access to pipe water into the drilling. 1,411, but only 12 have flush toilets in that particular area. Now, the point I was making in terms of how I would give you the support back is the next slide, where we can now show you. You see, we color-coded the water, so you can the shading of the area is based on whether you have water or not, like water. And then we do a pie chart, and the blue says flush toilets, so the residents here have virtually 100% flush toilets. And then the yellow is pit latrine, then you can see there's a combination. And then, of course, the green is no toilets. They paint a much easier picture to understand what your area looks like and what the community, and this is what is available to honorable members from that session. I want to then go on to one last point on that and show you the spatial statistics. And this is a study that we did, and the paper was published in Journal of Geoscience beginning of this year. We've tried to say, is there a relationship between the schools and the community?
You don't think it's your paper?
It's my paper, yes. Yeah, my paper. It's published in a recognized journal.
This is the work that we opened them, where I foreground this. About 1992, we were concerned about statisticians not understanding geography and policy not understanding statistics. So we've been seized by this over a very long period of time, and we worked with the University of Potosi. 2010, we were able to establish a center at Stellenbosch with the person that I was working with at Potosi to create a center for regional and urban exploration and statistical innovation, urban innovation and statistical exploration, and we took Deputy Director General, Chief Director, to go and do that work. And every year I'm taking 15 people from my office to go and start this. So that we are able to... It is too important for South Africa development not to have urban and regional scientists. So our statisticians are now continuously... We started in 2011, and the chief and the study were the first in out of 14 that went there. Now where did you go? Last year, the other 20. We have about 60 people now. So it's very, very important to pay attention to this and focus on them. So the paper that the site is talking about was the product of this work.
Thanks. I think we looked here to say the dots are the schools, the high schools, and the population is shown by the color code. You see the areas here, more population. And I want you to know, is there a relationship between the pass rates in the school and the socioeconomic surrounding the economy? What is the socioeconomic status of the community? And then in the literature, in this particular case, what we've also done is I put this onto an aerial photograph. So now you can see what the houses around the school look like. Is it informal houses? Is it high wall? What kind of houses it is? And I should say, I think you got it early, yeah. The research showed that you could have four levels that could determine the whole leg, that could determine the contributing factors. The one is the education department syllabus, is it outcomes-based education or CAPS? The second is
does the school have enough funding, are the teachers qualified, and so on. And the third is, does the students or the learners pay attention, do they attend class, do they do the homework, and so on. But then there was a fourth one, which said, what is the socio-economic level or socio-economic factors of the community? And what we found that there was a Coleman report in 1966 that looked at 4,000 schools across the U.S. to investigate the poor school performance of African-American students. And the report found that the learner's personal and family characteristics were the major contributing influence on the student's performance, and not the characteristics of the school they attended. So in that light now, you do this example, and what I found... Yes.
Before you proceed on that. In South Africa, the human condition, we go back to that that factor, that the circumstances, the learners, that the family circumstances in which learners grow are a fundamental issue to their development. Now, if you take an Indian family and the child in an Indian family, the circumstances are totally different than the white guy. If you take a black child, the father is not even there, he's taking the grandmother. The family circumstances are such that we are not going to defeat this thing until we have addressed those kinds of things. That's what we have to confront. But Dr. Lai, you can proceed. I think some students do well, but those are rare things. It's rare, and we celebrate a rarity, but it cannot be a standard. And those are the things that confront us, and we have to tackle them.
So when we run this, I ran a hotspot analysis, and what we found that the schools in this particular area here all performed fairly poorly, and the neighboring schools as well. Whereas the schools, that's the Middleton area, the high school and the figures are all performing well, and this is more the Kailisa Mitchell's plain area. And if you go and run a Ansel and Altaya, the question then comes up, if you look at Kailisa, all the blues, then there's one school here that's performing well. Now you need to investigate further to say why. What is that school doing right in the middle of non-performing high schools, this particular one school is doing well? And then I went and built a regression model, and we found a good relationship. Now those of you who've got some statistics background, you can see the p-values are all significant. That means it's a good fit. The model is good. So the pass rate can be a function of employment, percentage of employment, and telephone and computer. And look at employment, but again, it's not 0.13. So what we've in fact done now, we can say, yeah, we built a model, we can now give it to the policymakers and say, apply. But what if, in fact, the real data is like that? Can you see how wrong our model is by grouping the data? We need to look at the data more at a local, spatial level. Now, in the literature, I found a similar example as in Cape Town. In most parts of the country, the age of the house determines the price. Newer houses are a lot more expensive than old houses. So if you take Arrow, Belleville, the southern suburbs, it's the same in Cape Town. But if you come closer to Wenberg near the mountain, the old houses are far more expensive than the new houses. So you see, on one side, we have a negative slope. On the other side, we have a positive slope. But when you group all the data together, you know, you miss this picture. And this is what the Simpson's paradox is saying. And coming back to what I showed earlier, geography and the space, why you need to do this analysis on a spatial distance that you come through. And then what we're able to do, in terms of explaining it in statistics terms, if the data is stationary, then you can group them all together. And stationary is, if you take a first-year university student, doing test one or so, you take any group of them, the average age should be the same, no matter which 20 people you select on the class. But if you take the test and say, I took all the workers, the staff, you can't just use any 20 and get the same age. So in that case, the school data or the university students, it's stationary, you can group it. When it's non-stationary, you can't group it. And then, and when you color code it, you see this non-stationarity when you've got different colors. And you saw earlier in the SD presentation how the colors were changing. So showing you the different pattern in the data. So if the data is non-stationary, then we have to look at different techniques to analyze it. And one of them that we look at is, I'm going to skip this. If you think of this
think of a helicopter flying a shadow over the school. All the schools that are under the shadow, you do a regression. And then helicopter flies, new schools get added, others get removed. So you go across the study area like that and do a number of regression analysis, and that's called geographically weighted regression. And therefore, if you go back, remember how point value was, coefficient was 0.13, and you see how it varies across Lisbon and Cape Town. And this is the value now that proved and going to Stellenbosch University brought to us to do this kind of analysis. And of course, I'm continuing to say it's free, and we are available to come and train and to look at the data. What I'd like to do is to conclude by switching to the iPad.
Before you conclude on this, could you go back to what the determinants of the performance are on that equation?
On this one, this particular one we got?
Yes, yes, that's on the...
This one.
You see, there is environment, telephone, and computer. We know that the employment is very difficult. I mean, if you use this model for the South African situation, the South African child is doomed. The black child is doomed here. Because there's no employment, there is a cell phone, but there's no computer. Now the question is, how will policy, what are the policy choices to influence employment or outcomes of education? Surely the computer is then, we know the prices of computers are dropping. And in fact, technology-based training is what will actually resolve the bulk of our problems. So, our investment probably should be in technology. Employment is a little bit far because it's a very difficult thing to... But computer you can buy, cell phone you can buy. You may not buy a parent, because the conditions under which children live, we have to look at how we deal with the condition of children at home. But the computer seems to be, technology seems to be the most possible to drive our education, so that that education then creates conditions for employment. So these are things that we really need to bring, and they are not... There are not things you will not do when you're not trained. We need technocrats in government to do this kind of thing. You get bureaucrats in different states, but it's never doing this thing. They'll outsource it. And you need technocrats who can handle this thing, this time. Bureaucrats who are technocrats. Otherwise, they'll outsource it. And then, of course, outsourcing will give you a very interesting result. That is not what you intended. You can continue, sir.
I think if you, while I'm connecting, I just want to talk about the harmonized data. What we've done with the ward data, we've taken the current ward boundaries, previous boundaries, we overlaid it spatially so we could redraw them, so we can now tell you what the position is currently and what it was for the current boundary in 2001 and 96. And in that respect, you remember in Silvertown when we did the analysis, the proportion of bucket toilets in Silvertown in PE, in 96 census was 98% of the community had bucket toilets. And then in the 2001 data, the number dropped from 98% to 96%. In 15 years, you have a difference. Whereas there's another area in Bloemfontein where more than half the community, 5,500 houses had bucket toilets out of 11,000, it dropped to 500. So from about 50% to 0.5%. You can see the change. So we have that data available which we can come to. The question of how do we get our data and what happened, I know honorable members all have an iPad. We've got an application called Rombi, which is on the status there. If you just click on it, it takes you to the status site. Now what happens here, we put out all these releases, and you download once and the release gets onto your iPad. So when you're on the airplane, you can then look at it or anytime. So what I'm going to specifically show is, if I can get to this one. This is the first...
It's not wrong.
It's plugging itself out. Let's see. Okay. The very top one there says... It's upside down. I put it this way. It says non-final...
StandardEd produces about 171 different publications. And some publications are monthly, others quarterly. So we go over 300 different publications in one calendar year. And this is just one, some of them that you can see as they go through. You can look at them, download them, and go through. And I picked up the one year, which is, if I magnify it, non-financial census of municipality. There's an example. So when you click on it, what's nice about it, you read it like a book. You see, you turn the pages as you go through. And when you go into key fundings, you can also click on the services, and it gives you the different values. You can see, let's get to an earlier one. Yeah, see here you have bucket toilets, there's a glass there by problem, and if you just move it, it switches the numbers. So it's also interactive. So you have a number of these publications which you can download onto your iPad whenever you have time. You don't need to connect to the internet, you can go through and you can read it, and some of it is interactive. And then I can go back into the website. Our website has just been revamped. We still have a long way to go with some of the data issues, but...
No, sir.
Yes, sir.
Citizens members are indicating that they may need to move out for other missions.
Yes.
There's searching it through. And I think they want to move for other missions.
Yes. All right.
I don't care about the comment of them, but I've been here... But this one is full of photos. not the real data. That's it.
Chair, I note that the Rombia application is only available for the iPad, according to your website, and more than 50% of us have Android devices. So I'd like to suggest, Dr. Naidu, that as a matter of urgency, you look at porting it to an Android device for the rest of us.
Doctor, I thought that maybe because these members, it seems all of them except me, they're extremely advanced technology. And then I'm still the one who's very backward. Even been in terms of in general. He's very advanced now. iPad and everything are there. But he still stays at school. But I thought that, Doctor, maybe we shouldn't really take much of your time. In terms of this, because the colleagues maybe they know this thing, I think, in general. But the point that I think we're trying to get on is just to raise an issue about us using the data that we make it available for us to better the living conditions of the population. Because I think the data is for us to be informed by when we make policies. We must be informed by data. We shouldn't just look at photos. I know that when you're looking at photos and we arrive at a policy position, I think that's what we wanted really to achieve. I know that members will want us to attend to other areas. It would be a good idea, though, the petition general also to agree in the meeting that even next year we should have this interaction. And because we'll assist members when they go for oversight function to go ahead and read where there are problems. And try to assist the information as a result of the time. If they're well informed, I think we must do that. And then next year, we must make time for all as madam, on our level. Again, another discussion that we'll have, longer discussion. And I know that during the week, it's very difficult sometimes, but I think on Friday's members will sacrifice one Friday and three. It's not a very discussion because we're in Costa. You're supposed to assist us to resolve all the problems that they have identified. I think it's important that we do that in general. And I think also, I think the Costa people, you know, they must know the doctor of their family. Otherwise, you know the mother world only, nothing else. and then there's South Africa to you, it has only TE. Why the thing that South Africa that you are representing here? But I think we should do that in general because the more we have this data, the more we become better politicians. The more we can then really deal with the real issues correctly. The point that we are raising is that sometimes the data is not for political gaining. We can use it, of course, in the debate, but it's meant to inform members of parliament who are making laws.
They don't make a law that is going to contradict everything that we have been doing for the last 10 years. And then leaving the children again, you're standing. I'm very happy now that Sandy is only rich because he's a pensioner. This is the terrible situation. It's a terrible situation that you wait until you are 60 to become rich with $1,400. It is a bigger problem that is facing us, I guess, fascinating. This triple challenge that you are facing, I think, is a bigger problem. But what would be your concluding remarks, though, Mr. General, for Bob Tashin that is here? And of course, maybe we take a view that we are assisting us, really, not directives. We are airing our views as South Africans. What is it that we can do to ensure that we don't continue the things that we are saying we are continuing with? And sometimes we do these things, it's as easy to do than to share other things, and as a result of that, then we end up perpetuating what we meant to defeat. I think the big problem. But that's how I'm around education. It's very important because members of parliament, we've got constituencies. And then we put ideas on time that every member knows the constituency proper. Performance of schools and what are these issues that I think we're talking about tonight. And then, because unless we know the surrounding of our schools, we wouldn't know really the modern schools. I know that you're not even in the government school body. And generally, you think education comes from health. But I think it's important that we do that now. If we don't do that, we'll be able to address some of the challenges we are facing. Of course, we do play politics, but I was a bit surprised. But there's an issue that is raised up. Politics, that is competition in politics. That by and large, always there are no national values that are accepted, can cause more disturbances. That's a very serious thing. This is the point you wanted to make about Western Cape. But I think, Citizen General, I think we must take a point and we'll assist us next year. The signature is here, and then the week is here. They will try to ensure that the next year we have some time. Again, just that it will be available if you are available. That's why we have discussion on this. Because the more you raise it, the more it makes us understand the real challenge. And then not the one that we think about, but the real challenges that we are facing on education, socio-economic condition, even the spatial development that is happening there. I think if you are raising a point, we have not built a single city. I think Mthatha is there for us. We have built Mthatha. And therefore, we are moving a little bit. And one day we are going to have a single city. And then move on that. Now, President General, I think we may want to conclude and have some discussion again. I think thank you for coming also to the truth speaker.
Thank you very much. I think I just want to conclude in with one few seconds in which I thought that we really have to start popularizing some of the things that we do.
Who would let my grandmother have to work for 20 minutes to get water and then sing for a real hard yo, you know, what did the husband do? What did the boss? Wait, look, I got the person said at me, my word, my counselor, all the information is there. See, Mom and Dad, smart messages for WhatsApp and Facebook.
Be sure to look at me. Take the light once. Let us say, I understand.
So, Chair, we thought that these are things that we can put as adverts so that the public knows that the data are there and they can actually help them resolve a few other things. It's something that we can do. But I think we are pleased that them could be here. Let me capture it this way, Chair. In the 14 years I've been statistician, there are 13 years and 10 months today. I've not addressed portfolio committees of parliament. I've only addressed our portfolio committee of finance, PCOF. But this year, I have now done 6 or so portfolio committees, and particularly just from June to now. And I think we have lost time on an important resource as that we have to be alive to. And we need to intensify that engagement. In fact, addressing portfolio committee, but also other departments present, so that we can actually have focused attention on things and we don't just miss. As in 13 years later, we find that, had we used the data, we would have done better. Because there was no intention not to use it. But it wasn't visible. So, myself, actually, in general, too, I'm guilty of not making the value of the data visible so that we can use it. So I think that the process at the moment is facilitating and enforcing every agency ability to do so. So we agree that early next year we could actually say let's regularly engage. Because on things like books, you know, the Limpopo saga has been dealt with somewhat. But you don't know what is happening in KwaZulu-Natal and Western Cape and all that. But books are not delivered at the same pace as they should. So we were paying attention to Limpopo because it was very dramatic. But underlying, there are things that are going wrong in other provinces. So we need regular engagements so that we can correct things. It's not to show anybody up, but it's basically to say, raise the problem, let's go and resolve it one by one. And then we can get this going. So we are very happy to be here, but I think we need a regular, say, once a quarter or once every 2 months, and then once we have regularized it, that it will be the beneficial.
Well, I think I would remember that taking the challenge.
I think one thing here, maybe, in a similar way like an Auditor General's office, in Parliament here, it's very easy to get the chief and auditor general representative to give you a backing on information. So maybe your office should be thinking of a similar arrangement, because you engage with department from time and again. You don't have this backup that they present their own thing is going this way. Yourself, you have your own. Maybe Parliament or your department should think very ready-made people who are a support base to committees such as this. Thank you very much.
Well, I think we will wait for the plea. As you are saying, I think it's fine. I think they will look at it. They will come back to us, have some discussion. But I think the view that we should have their own club, this is really intact. I think it will be very important because the committee then can do the real oversight function. And it's not because you are here with one march and everything that the marches are everywhere, that's not in Limpopo. It's a poor province, but there are no marches there. That they must be with wine and a march is there. Wine and a march is there. Some marches will be there everywhere. No, thank you very much. Thank you, Honorable Member. I think we are going to do that. We are going to be in touch with your office and discuss some of the issues. The information is very useful, at least for me and I think the team also. And then interact really with them from time to time. And maybe once in every quarter, it's fine, really. I think we can't fail to sacrifice 4 hours in time a quarter. Even one day a quarter, we have really sustained, because I think our information also is developing almost every day. And then what you're telling, that's the point that we're raising, that those who copy, they copy even wrong information. Alexander has 500,000 people and it's 900,000 people. He said that he was a copy. We really agree to do a compromise with the efficient general. Thank you for coming. And also thank for members for coming. We know that you meet on Tuesdays, but also we have agreed that you're meeting on Friday. Then the whole team has worked on that. Thank you, Doctor. I think train many of us to not joke that.
Thank you. I'm going to